Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, the origins and treatment of obesity are really pretty complex. For some individuals, the benefits of surgery even can begin to outweigh the risks. On this Line One program, we're going to discuss the causes and treatment of obesity, but particularly in the end of the program, maybe the last half, we're going to look at who are candidates for and what are the risks and benefits of the newer surgical options for obesity. My guest is Anchorage bariatric surgeon, Dr. Justin Clark. He served as a major at Joint-Based Elmendorf-Richardson Hospital until just recently, where he was director of bariatric surgery and assistant director of trauma surgery. He also is beginning to open his own practice shortly called Anchorage Bariatrics here in Anchorage. He's newly appointed as the director of metabolic and bariatric surgery at Providence Hospital and a participating member of the American Society of Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery. So if you've got questions or comments about obesity and its treatment, this would be a very opportune time to give us a call. Let me tell you a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Our local number in Anchorage, 550-8433. Toll free, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, as always, is line1@alaskapublic.org. Let me remind you, you have to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word. line1@alaskapublic.org. Ooh, Dr. Clark, after that long introduction, welcome.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here, Thad.
Let's start. You know, the word bariatric, I'm going to guess, is maybe not familiar to most listeners. Medicine's got its jargon. What do we mean when we say that you're a bariatric surgeon?
Well, bariatric in general is referring to specifically the obese patient. And it gets a little bit more in the broader context about, surgical options when you start saying bariatric. But if we look really into the numbers, we're talking about obesity, which is based on your body mass index, and we can go into that a little bit too.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead. Let's define what we mean by obesity. And at the same time, I'm sure there's listeners out there. We are pretty good at hedging our bets as humans. And is there a perfect way to define obesity? What's the problems with how we might define it? And why might people still want to pay close attention to BMI?
You know, BMI is not perfect, but to give you the definitions, so body mass index is a ratio of your weight to your height. There's a lot of calculators out there online that you can use to figure out your own BMI. But in general, a normal BMI is considered anything from about 18.5 to 25. 25 to 30 is considered overweight. 30 to 35 is obesity class 1. 35 to 40 is obesity class 2. And above a BMI of 40, you would be considered morbidly obese. It's not a perfect system by any means. If you want to look at specifically your body fat, you'd have to do something more definite like a bioelectrical impedance study. But what we know of body mass index is it roughly correlates with the bioelectrical impedance, and it's very highly correlates with your medical problems and conditions associated with being overweight.
So people like myself look at my BMI and say, whoa, I'm pretty high, but I feel like I'm in pretty good shape. What I hear you saying is that may be true, but the BMI, regardless of what I think of it, has a highly ability to predict complications later.
True. That's true. So someone who has a lot of muscle mass, let's say a bodybuilder, their BMI is actually going to be quite high. They might even be considered clinically obese, while obviously they're not, and that's because of their body mass is high. But if you look at the average person, BMI will correspond pretty well, pretty highly with medical conditions like high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, and sleep apnea.
And they bring their own complications.
Absolutely. So each of these can then have all sorts of long-term impacts on your health.
I don't think there's a listener out there that is not aware that being overweight and obese is much more prevalent than it used to be. You want to try to put some numbers on this for us?
I'd love to. So, you know, we've heard a lot about this obesity epidemic in this country. And if you look at the CDC, there's good slides on their website, but it shows back in about 1990, across the country, there was about a 10 to 15% obesity rate across our country. Looking just at 2010, just two decades later, we're looking at above a 30% nationwide obesity rate. So it's really ballooned up very, very quickly. So the word epidemic certainly does apply, I believe, to this this factor. The numbers themselves, about 35% of Americans are obese. 68, so about two-thirds of all Americans are either obese or overweight. And the predictions are only going up. So by 2050, we're looking at about a 42% rate of obesity in our country, and one in every three people is likely to have diabetes.
There's many things that have changed, let's say, in the last 25 to 30 years, increased in prevalence, like obesity. For another example is the amount of food allergy, the amount of asthma diagnosis. And the argument for that goes that there's no way that our genetic milieu, our genome, is going to change that rapidly so that genetics alone can account for that. Therefore, it must be environmental changes or environment acting on our genetics. So I'm guessing that if we were to say, why are we having more obesity, that the environmental factors must be important. And I'm choosing my words carefully. I'm not saying it's the only factor. Does that make sense also with obesity, this dramatic increase?
Absolutely, absolutely. If we look at, you know, the causes of this epidemic, you know, it's multifactorial. There's many reasons for this. On the most simplest level, we're looking at genetics, behavior, and the environment. But it's really when you start to delve into it a little bit more and looking at a lot of the really specific factors that are affecting our weight, it's things like the chemical and nutrient content of our food, our lack of physical activity, increased stress, inadequate and disrupted sleep, and the use of medications that lead to weight gain. So all of those things play a role, and each person's individual genetics is going to respond differently to all those factors. And some people are going to gain weight, and some people are not, who do all the same things. So I tend to, I have transitioned to thinking of obesity not just in the black and white, heavy or not heavy, but more as obesity as a biological response to our modern environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could think back, and I've thought about doing this in the office, is have a picture of a bunch of kids in school in 1950 compared to the same picture today so that people can get a better idea that the epidemiology that you've just discussed is real. It doesn't take much time. In the 50s now, kids were riding their bikes. They were outside almost all day. They didn't play games on computers or watch TV nearly to the same degree. So there was a tremendous amount of activity difference. And over the same period of time, food has become tremendously much more abundant and cheaper, at least for the higher caloric content foods that are readily available.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true.
So those are certainly important factors, but as you said, there's other things. The other thing we talked about before we came on the air is the psychology of eating a little bit. And so once we have these environmental changes and start to put on weight, things can get real difficult to reverse.
That's absolutely true as well. You know, I'm a big proponent of mindful eating, and that's a big part of my counseling to patients, and I have them read a book specifically about this. But the psychology of eating is an important topic, and it's one of the hardest things to change long term. But it's crucial for lowering your weight, and specifically after a surgery, of keeping that weight off.
We have a call, and I think if she called in very early, I'd like her to have a chance to make some comments. Mary, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Well, I was wondering more about the environmental factors, because one thing that is really noticeable that really can't be genetics is how feminized some of our boys look, and the breast size of women. I'm about 70 years old, and I'm old enough to remember that what size people used to be, even if they would be considered obese. And so what do we do about glyphosate and endocrine disruptors like bisphenol A and measurable amounts of pharmaceutical drugs in our water?
Okay. So those are some other very specific environmental influences that may be playing a role, I hear you saying. And you would like to know what we can say, particularly what Dr. Clark can say about this.
Yes, please.
Okie doke. Thanks very much. Our connection is not really good. If you don't mind, I'm going to have you take the call off the air, and then we'll address some of those issues, okay? All right. Dr. Clark.
You know, I hear your concern there, and it's really hard to put your finger on one specific thing that is leading to this this change in our society so rapidly. So all of the things that you mentioned certainly play a role. I don't know if any one of them is in particular is significant or not significant, but I think we have to look at our society in general and think mindfully about everything that we're doing, and specifically about the chemical and nutrient contents of the food and the medications we're using.
So there are definitely, and you correct me if I'm wrong here, that things like BPA and some of the endocrine disruptors are associated with changes, particularly in animals rather than humans, although there may be some human things. But the issue becomes what percentage of all of the problems we're having with obesity that we can actually clearly attribute to these things. And I'm hearing you say it's a factor, but it may not be the biggest factor, despite some of the publicity it might get. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. You know, there's so many things that play into this. If I had to really put my finger on a couple of the most important ones, it would be the food. It mm-hmm. would be the decrease in physical activity, mm-hmm. Stress, lack of sleep, and then the medications mm-hmm. that we use specifically for a lot of depression management that can increase your weight. I think those are the big factors that we know about, but certainly there's probably many others that we don't.
Another factor I've heard get blamed sometimes, and it seems to me is inappropriate, the earlier onset of puberty, particularly in girls, which has been shown over the last 25 years to be somewhat true. But my understanding now is the primary driver of the early onset of puberty is actually obesity, not the chemicals that we're exposed to. And that's been looked at pretty hard, in a sense that it made sense to look at the chemicals, but when we looked at it, that was not the problem. And yet there's still this misconception. It's easy to think that way.
Yeah, you know, being obese, in your fat cells, you know, there is a release of estrogen. So as people get heavier, you have more response or more exposure to estrogen. And we know that in at least obese adults, you have a higher disposition towards certain kinds of cancers,
right.
Specifically breast cancer and colon cancer, mm-hmm. And breast being very, very important with estrogen response.
Right, right. Yeah, we hadn't thought about that, but many of the cancers, which people don't like to talk about, but clearly have a relationship with being overweight, and that's not as knowledgeable as people would have thought.
No, it's certainly something that's just coming to light.
Let me also remind listeners once again, my guest today is Dr. Justin Clark. He is a physician who practices treating patients with obesity problems, and he is a surgeon. He also does bariatric surgery, and he's the newly appointed director of metabolic and bariatric surgery at Providence Hospital. We're talking about, at this particular time, obesity in general, what we know about it, and then later, for those of you who are interested, we're going to get into some of the newer surgical options. If you've got questions or comments, again, please don't hesitate to give us a call. Locally, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Another issue that comes to my mind when I think about obesity is that our healthcare costs in this country far exceed that of any other country, and the costs associated with obesity are somewhat of a driving factor. But as I sit here and try to make a point, I'm also realizing that we should also point out that this problem is not just an American or an Alaskan problem. This is a Western society kind of issue. As countries become richer, there seems to be everybody suffers this problem.
Absolutely. You look in Asian countries, which have historically been lower BMI populations, as the Western diet has infiltrated that area, we see a direct correlation with increase in weight, BMI, and the associated medical problems. So while we're leading the way, we're certainly not the only ones in the world anymore.
Mm-hmm. And Western diet, I suspect our Western way of living associated with less activity is also true.
Absolutely. We've taken our activity levels down partly because of technology. We have labor-saving technology. Most of us sit at the computer all day long. Most of us have the ready abundance of food. I can walk down to the cafeteria and I can get a very large quantity of food for a relatively small amount of money, and it's not the best food. Mm-hmm. So it's real easy. We're not hunters and gatherers anymore. So I don't know that our body's genetics have changed all that much in that time. And so this change in our activity is greatly affecting our obesity rates.
Let's get back to the psychology of obesity and treatment. And I guess the way I would frame this is it certainly appears to me that everybody is beginning to understand that most of the medical approaches to obesity do not have good long-term results. I think more people are aware since the Greatest Loser program has recently been reevaluated to see even the people who've lost tremendous percentage of their weight bounce right back up again. So the question then becomes surgery, which we're going to talk about, but what about the mindful eating, the psychology, and some of the tricks or hints of how we can address this outside of the purely medical model?
Yeah. So I have a lot to say about that subject. I think for the lower BMI patient, the people who are out there who may be overweight by 20 or 30 pounds, I think a really good lifestyle modification plan can make a big difference in lowering their weight and keeping it off. And that's doing things like regular exercise, cardiovascular exercise and weight training, but also in what you're eating, the quality of your food, the quantity of your food, the frequency of how you're eating, and then the mindfulness of it. So this is things where we eat a lot of times in front of the television. And study after study shows that we end up eating a lot more during that time than we would if we were concentrating on what we were doing. Or going to these large stores and buying massive quantities of food. But when you open a bag of chips that size, you have no idea how many servings that you're eating. And so it's easy behavioral changes to not necessarily keep that stuff out of your house, which would be wonderful, but in partitioning it up and getting the rest of it out of sight, because the harder you make something to do, the easier it's going to be to not do it. Things like drinking soda. If it's sitting there in your fridge every time you open it up, it's real easy to drink it. If you don't buy it and you really want one and you have to drive down to the store to get it, you're not going to drink as much. Mm-hmm. And it's little things like that that we can do to impact our overall mindful eating.
So that kind of idea of any behavioral change has been found repeatedly is if we work hard at trying to identify the temptations and make those temptations harder, it's much, much more successful than just willing ourselves to not go over there and eat that piece of cake. If the cake's not there, it's much harder to do. It's been shown over and over and over again in all kinds of behavioral changes is what I'm hearing you say is an important part of this.
Absolutely. Anytime you give yourself more time to make a decision, you end up, or you're more likely to make the right decision. So if you have a jar of Hershey's Kisses sitting next to your keyboard and your computer, you have almost no decision-making time before you grab that and eat it. But even if you put it across the room on a shelf, the studies will show that the amount that you consume will be less simply because you have to get up, you have to walk over there, and you have to do it. And that gives you time to think about it.
I also appreciated your comment about the television and what we're doing, and it made me think of someone who I can't remember where I heard this now, but his approach to obesity is recognizing, this was a talking to kids, parents of kids, is that many of the kids, the reason they're obese is they're just flat out bored. They're not active. They're not engaged in things. And so part of his treatment was, what are you interested in? And then really do a lot of that just to get rid of the boredom. Because if we're sitting around, we're not engaged, we're not thinking, we're in front of a TV or we're sitting there eating as a response to the boredom, so to speak. I thought that was a very good comment that he made.
Yeah, I think that's very, very insightful. And, you know, that's really great for the lower BMI patients, and it's really important for our heavier patients as well. You know, unfortunately, what we find is that for patients who are clinically obese, it's really, really difficult for them to lose weight and keep it off. In the order of about 2 to 5% of patients can do that. So we have 95% of patients who can't. And I can tell you over and over, my patients tell me, they diet, they exercise, they go on these different diets. As soon as they stop, they gain all the weight back and sometimes more.
Okay. All right. Sorry to interrupt you. We have another caller. I want to ask her a question. Sheila, you're on line one.
Hello.
Hi. What can we do for you?
I just was making a note on my notepad here about what the doctor just said about keeping the weight off being the hard part. I had bariatric surgery 5 years ago, and I did very well, and I'm very happy with my outcomes, but I'm starting to gain weight back, and I'm just feeling like I'm losing the battle again.
Right.
I've put on about 15 pounds, almost 20 pounds, in the last 2 years, and so and it's not all at once. It just creeps up,
right.
And I'm wondering if he would share the name of the book about mindful eating and
yeah, let's get his comments. Yeah, I hate to hear that, but I can understand it, unfortunately.
Yep. Yeah, you know, you're in a very common situation, and I appreciate your call today. The book itself is called Mindless Eating. It's by a PhD named Brian Wansink. It's Wansink. I provide that book to all of my patients to read. When you see me, I think it's a really good, it's actually a fun read. They talk a lot about studies and the psychology of eating. But to get back to your point about the weight gain, this is a common thing that we see as we do more and more bariatric surgery. So a couple years ago is the last time we have data, 2014, there's about 200,000 people in the country who underwent bariatric surgery. And we have very good results, which we'll talk about later, but we have an 85% success rate, but about 15% of patients will gain weight back. And the important part about that is identifying it early, which it sounds like it is in your case, and finding what's going on. I can tell you that in my experience, 90% of the time, it's not from the surgery itself. while I investigate all the possible complications of the surgery or the reasons for that, it's usually a behavioral thing, which we need to identify and modify. But the important is catching it early before you've gained all the weight back. Another really important thing that I can't stress enough is support. Even though you're 5 years out, support is a really crucial part about maintaining your weight loss. And all the studies show conclusively that people who are part of a good support system or post-operative support group do better long-term than those who don't go to those. And that's a pillar of my practice is the support system that we set up. And it's something that I always offer to all of my patients, and it's always free.
So, you know what? I know you're right about that. I did that the first 3 years religiously because I snowboarded between Alaska and Arizona, and I had my surgery in Arizona, and I'd go to my support groups. But up here, I haven't done that, so I maybe need to see about that. Is that something I could find online or?
Absolutely. If you go to the website, you can find out how to contact us, and we can set you up with our support groups.
Yeah, alaskapublic.org, look up line one. We've got a link to Dr. Clark's website as well.
Okay. So, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Sheila, and good luck. So I guess that raises the question, why is it that support groups work? And I can think of a couple of reasons off the top of my head, so it's usually multiple reasons, but why do you think support groups are such an important part of maintaining weight loss?
Well, you know, I can sit here in front of you and tell you all day what it's going to be like after a surgery, but I've never had it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And the only people who really can tell you are the people that have done it. And so I encourage all of my patients to attend our support groups before and after surgery as a means of seeing, you know, what you're really getting yourself into here. You know, and then it's a matter of just that support is I know what you're going through. These people know what you're going through. They may have identified things that help them, things that are bad that they can help you with.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking another reason is just purely some peer pressure kinds of things.
Oh, yeah.
You want to try to do your best for everybody else.
Yeah, and that same thing applies to exercise, too, you know.
Yeah. And another hint I'd heard about with exercise is just really finding something that you enjoy doing. You just, it's got to, if you tell somebody to go run, you know, it's not always going to work. But if there's some gardening, something that you stay busy with, getting back to the advice that one physician told me about treating obesity in kids is find something that they're interested in so they're not just bored and sitting around and eating.
Yeah, there's no one answer for everyone. Everyone's going to do well with different sorts of exercise, and it's just finding the right one.
And we haven't said it, but maybe we should say the success of any diet you find anywhere, anytime is how good?
pretty poor. Pretty poor. Over and over again, I have patients who have tried 10, 15, 20 different diets.
Right.
And they work great while you're on them, but when you go off them, most people will gain the weight back and more. Same thing applied to Biggest Loser.
Okay. All right, we're going to take our break, and then I'm going to come back and ask, why do diets initially work, and then why do they not work? And I think it's important to understand some thermodynamics that we keep missing, but I'll let Dr. Clark fill us in on that. So let me remind you once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this very short break, we're going to continue our discussion on obesity and the surgical options to treat these problems with Dr. Justin Clark. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage bariatric surgeon, Dr. Justin Clark. We're discussing obesity and the treatment options, the reasons for obesity, and we're going to spend most of the next half hour or next part of the show on surgery and surgical options, risks, benefits, success, and so forth. You can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433, or you can also call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And remember also, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m., you're listening on a Monday evening, you're listening to a taped recording, and we will not be available to answer your questions at that particular time. Before I get back to Dr. Clark, I have promised a physician in town to do kind of a public service announcement. This idea originates from the pediatric gastroenterologist, Dr. Claire Wilson in town, who had called me and said, you know, I've seen three kids very recently who have swallowed some small button or disc batteries, and I don't think people understand how dangerous this can be. So for people's information, let me just point out that every year in the United States, more than 3,500 people of all ages have been known to swallow these small disc-like button batteries. They're used for power to power hearing aids, watches, toys, games, flashing jewelry, singing greeting cards, remote control devices, and many, many other items. Most of these button batteries will really actually pass through your body and are eliminated. However, sometimes the batteries get hung up or caught, and what happens then is that the tissue on each side of that battery will set up an electric current and very, very quickly can cause some significant problems. This risk is highest for lithium button batteries, which are more commonly being used recently because of more power. They're usually about the right size to get hung up, particularly in the esophagus, about 3/4 of an inch. This another risk factor is children less than 5, and as I've already alluded to, the if it gets stuck in the esophagus. So if you're aware or suspect of a small button battery has been ingested, it's very important to seek some medical attention. You can also call the National Poison Control Center. Even better, take care to prevent young children from playing with products that contain these small button or disc-like batteries. One other brief comment that Dr. Wilson did not mention that I still see as a pediatrician is that when you swallow multiple small magnets, not just one, but multiple ones, you can also end up with serious complications. So be careful about particularly young kids and swallowing button batteries and even multiple small batteries. All right, Dr. Clark, thanks for putting up with that. Let's get back. We were talking about diets and why the evidence is that diets don't work, but you commented that you often initially lose weight on diets but only rebound back. Why do most diets seem to work initially and therefore are easy to sell to the public and then fail?
Well, that's a great question. I have a lot to say about that. But most diets are designed to be temporary. They are designed to offer you weight loss very quickly, but they're not designed to change your lifestyle, your eating habits on the long term. And so, you know, a lot of people, well, I need to lose 10 pounds to go to this wedding. It's real easy to do. But the second you stop doing that, you'll gain it back. And that's a common occurrence. One of the reasons I think that diet overall fails and people regain weight is something that's coming to light with really exciting new research about something called the set point. And the best way that I can kind of describe this to the listeners is let's imagine a thermostat in your house, and it's set at, say, 72 degrees, and you cannot change it no matter what you do. Well, in the wintertime, if you're too hot, what are you going to do? You're going to open the window, and you're going to let a bunch of cold air come into your house to try to lower the temperature. Well, what is your house going to do in response to that? It's going to kick on your furnace, and it's going to blow hot air until it gets you back to that 72 degrees. And it doesn't matter how long that window is open. Well, the same thing happens with our brain. The brain has a thermostat, and it regulates your energy levels, which is your fat content, essentially. It doesn't regulate your specific weight. But when you go on a diet, what happens is your body wants to get you back to that set point. And so it increases your cravings. It actually lowers your metabolism and has all of these factors that it applies to your body to help you regain the weight back to its set point. And I think the more and more we look at this, the more, you know, not only does it just make sense, but the science behind it is pretty good.
There are actually, as you may have implied, as I was kind of thinking about some other things, is that actually there's feedback loops oftentimes in our health with hormones and so forth. And there are a lot of chemicals that kind of maintain a particular circuit to be exactly functioning the same thing. And so what happens with obesity, as I'm hearing you saying, is that our set point gets changed up higher. It resets or gets kind of almost stuck like that thermostat, and now everything readjusts to that. And so every time we try to change that, it just there's too much working against us to go right back to the same point again.
Absolutely, that's exactly the concept. And I think what we know is that the hormones in our body play a crucial component in this. And whereas, you know, all surgeons, you know, medical professionals, we always thought that doing a surgery to remove a portion of the stomach simply worked because it prevented you from eating more food and maybe decreased the amount that you absorb. And yet what we're finding is probably the true mechanism, while those are important, is that it's changing the hormones of the GI tract in your body to help reset your set point at a lower level.
The surgery itself changes
surgery
the
itself, yeah.
Because that's where these hormones either originate or where the cells that they are acting on are no longer there.
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. I'll give you a really good example of that. One that we know a lot about is something called ghrelin. And it is a hormone that increases your appetite. So when your stomach is empty, it secretes ghrelin. It goes to your brain. It says, I'm hungry, eat. When your stomach is stretched out and full, that hormone level goes down, and then your body, you don't feel hungry anymore. And we know that those cells, that ghrelin is secreted mostly from the fundus of the stomach, and that is either removed by surgery or bypassed, depending on the surgery. And we've documented decreased ghrelin mm-hmm. levels in postoperative patients for well over a year after surgery.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to take one more call, and then I really want to spend some time on the surgery, which we've delayed getting to, but I want to make sure we have plenty of time. Janice, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I was just listening, and I attend Overeaters Anonymous, and it's a program that a lot of people don't know that's out there, but it seems it has worked for me. I've got a weight loss of 100 pounds, and I've kept it off for a number of years, and I did all the other diets, and you know, just wanted to put a word out there that, you know, we promote that it's a disease of the mind and an allergy of the body, and that there is a solution that has worked for a number of people. So we have members that have had bariatric surgery that have relapsed and have regained weight, and just wanted to let your listeners know that that might be something that they could try in addition. If, you know, we're not promoters or, you know, we don't say you shouldn't have bariatric surgery, but we'll support anyone that has eating problems, and there's all kinds of solutions through that 12-step program.
Yeah, you know what? I think the really important part about your comment there is the support component that you mentioned. So,
yeah.
You know, having that support and having those peers undergo the same thing is really crucial. And if you can do that, I think it's going to work for some people, and there's going to be some people that it doesn't work for. But absolutely, I think anything you can get yourself into that's having support is going to be more beneficial than not.
It is. It really is. Well, thank you. This is a good program, and thanks for letting me share.
You bet. Thanks for your call, Janice. All right, Dr. Clark, let's get to the surgery issues. And I want to just make sure listeners are aware we are somewhat purposely avoiding, I'm purposely avoiding talking about medications that may be used to control appetite. We haven't talked much about physical activity. There's just a limited amount of time to do what we want to get done. So it's not that we don't think those are possible helps or aids, but probably all by themselves, they're not the sole answer either. Let's talk about bariatric surgery. What do we need to know?
Well, you know, there's a lot of new options out there. So everyone is very familiar with hearing about the gastric bypass surgery. And certainly that's the surgery that's been performed the most over the last 20 years. But within the last 5 to 10 years, we've really diversified our ability to perform surgery and now non-surgical procedures to help with weight loss. It's really all based on BMI. So depending on what your BMI, it'll give us an idea of what kind of intervention you qualify for. And in my part of my practice, I offer physician-monitored diets and medication-assisted weight loss, which is great for some people. But for people who are past that, I think having the surgical component is a big part of the practice as well. So to give you a brief overview of the things that we perform in our practice, we do the gastric bypass, the sleeve gastrectomy, the duodenal switch procedure, and we're branching out into the newer procedures that are now FDA approved, something called the V-block device, as well as the Orbera intragastric balloon, which is really an exciting option for some people out there.
So let's talk about the first three a little bit. What we know, what are the risks, what are the benefits, who are candidates for those older ones before we get to these newer ones?
At least
that's what I want to know because I haven't heard so much about the newer ones either.
So gastric bypass sleeve and the switch, they are they're laparoscopic surgery, so they're minimally invasive, but they are the most invasive options among the bunch. Right now, the national criteria is that if your body mass index is above 40, you qualify for surgery. But we can also accept down to a body mass index of 35 if you have a significant medical condition associated with being overweight. And unfortunately, that's not, you know, arthritis or irregular menstrual cycles, things like that. It's stuff that's going to shorten your life. And that's things like high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, and obstructive sleep apnea. Also, probably within the next year, they're looking to decrease that qualification, probably to somewhere in the BMI of 32 to 33 for people with diabetes, because it's so effective at improving diabetes.
Now, are we talking about just those two things you were talking about, older surgeries that most of us think about when we think about bariatric surgery? Those are the criteria for those particular ones.
Those are the exactly for the
greater
bypass.
Than 40 BMI, greater than 35 with significant medical complications, diabetes, high blood pressure, obstructive sleep apnea, and increased cholesterol. All right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. What are the risks?
So, you know, I think people think about surgery, think about bariatric surgery. They have the concepts of what it was 10, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit riskier back then. But as a society, we've taken really, really important steps to making this surgery as low risk as possible. And so everything is done on protocol. You know, I can tell you that there are some complications with surgery. The main ones that we worry about early are a leak from the connection sites, blood clots in your legs or your lungs, and things of those natures. All of this is less than 1% chance. And the risk of dying is 0.28%. So it's really, really low. And part of it is, you know, we take a very long time getting someone to surgery. We do a lot of workup. And this is elective surgery. The last thing we need to do is have someone choose to have surgery and do poorly. We want everyone to do well. So we take great pains in getting people through surgery safely.
Mm-hmm. What's the risk of weight gain later, or failure of the surgery to achieve the goals that you were trying to get?
There's two ways to look at it. There's one is people who don't lose any weight at all after surgery. With these type of surgeries, the chance of that is very low. Most people are going to lose a good or significant amount of weight. It's the people that end up gaining it back. Right now, the national data shows about a 15% chance of people undergoing weight regain after surgery. It's after 5 years. And I think as we do more and more bariatric surgery, that number will start to creep up more towards the 20 to 25% range.
And that's significantly less than the medical approach, however. I guess I would be the first to point out it, and I'm not a surgeon.
Right. You know, if we look at people who just do diet and exercise,
right,
who are obese to begin with, you know, we'll succeed, you know, 2 to 5% of the time. Mm-hmm. But if we add in surgery, we can get an 85% success rate. Mm-hmm. And I think the important thing, my point here, is that it's not just surgery that's causing this weight loss. It's the surgery is just a tool, and it's a tool that needs to be used with diet and exercise program and behavior modification. So it's those combined that can lead to the increased success.
And I try to say as often as I get a chance to on this program that the issue of making a decision about any medical treatment, anybody, anywhere, or suggest you ought to encompass this thought process, unless you can tell me a better way, is that what's the risk of doing it and what's the risk of not doing it? So for people that have a BMI greater than 35 and these medical complications already present, those greater than 40, it seems to me it must be very clear that the risk of surgery is less than not doing the surgery at all. So that's part of the reason why this is becoming very important.
That's absolutely the case, you know, and I think every major insurance carrier covers this surgery because they recognize that while there's an upfront cost associated with it, that long-term, the resolution of diabetes or improvement, getting off the medications and all the complications that can occur with diabetes or other medical problems, they end up saving money in the long-term.
All right. What else do we need to talk about?
So the new FDA-approved balloon that's out there, there's a couple different varieties. That is, one is called the Orbera intragastric balloon. Another is called the ReShape device. I myself perform the Orbera procedure. And what's interesting is that this is indicated down to a BMI of 30. So it really opens up a whole new patient population in terms of weight loss options. It's non-surgical. It's placed by a camera that goes down the throat. And to give you an idea, it's about a water balloon. I think of it as a water balloon about the size of a grapefruit. Goes down in your stomach, makes you feel full. And it's really good for some people. And it stays in for 6 months, and then we can take it out with a camera down the throat, too. So it's non-surgical. The only downside is that insurance doesn't cover this at the moment. And so we have to figure out a way to pay for that separately.
And insurance doesn't cover it, I'm going to guess, because there's not enough evidence to show that it – well, if it's safe and effective, then the FDA has already determined that it's safe and effective. The insurance companies just got to see that it's cost effective for them, I guess, is the argument.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's actually been performed over 200,000 times in 80 countries. There's a lot of good data on it, but it's just newly available in the United States. And so we're going to see how that all plays out long term. But to give you an idea of the results that we're looking at, we kind of measure success in terms of weight loss, which in my opinion is really the fourth most important thing of having surgery. To give you my take on that, most of all, my goals for you after surgery are to increase your quality of life, to change your metabolism from a fat burning to a fat, from a fat storing to a fat burning metabolism, to get rid of some of your medical problems associated with being overweight, and then weight loss as the fourth most important thing. But everyone kind of measures their success by the weight that they lose. And we measure it by excess weight loss. So let's say that based on your height, you should weigh 140 pounds, but you weigh 240 pounds. So your excess weight loss or your excess weight is 100 pounds. And so we can measure objectively on this scale how much of that you lost. And so if we look at things like the Orbera intragastric balloon, the average excess weight loss is about 40 pounds. So that patient would lose, you know, to about 200 pounds on average. If we get things like the sleeve gastrectomy and the gastric bypass, we're looking at about 65 to 75% excess weight long term. So that patient would lose 65 to 75%. And I can tell you from looking at my own data that our practice is 73.8% excess weight loss long term. So we're consistent with the national averages.
What are complications?
Well, we really have to go into each procedure itself to identify the different complications. But in general, if during the education component of our class, we go through all of this stuff in detail. But with the balloon itself, most people have a lot of nausea. They can have some vomiting, bloating. It usually gets much improved after about a week. But the first week can be pretty tough.
All right. But not not dangerous, maybe unpleasant.
No, it's unpleasant. There's the small risk of perforation or a hole in the stomach or an ulcer forming.
Right. But
the data that we have shows those are all well less than 1%.
Has the Obera, this intragastric balloon, been around long enough that we can say what our long-term results are? You said you take these things out in 6 months, so I'm saying, I haven't changed my mindful eating. I'm going to go right back to where I was. Is there evidence that that happens? And then also, can you put it back in again?
Great. Those are great questions. So, and I'm glad you brought that up, because putting the Orbera in while it's in for 6 months, you're part of a 12-month program.
Okay.
And so during that first 6 months, you have monthly visits with a dietitian, and we really try to work on changing diet and exercise, lifestyle, and then that's maintained for 6 more months after the device comes out.
All right.
You can put the device back in.
So the Obera is part of a long-term
attempt
to change your lifestyle.
Exactly. It's the first part of a two-part system,
right?
Which I think is an important point to recognize. It can go back in. Usually we wait at least 3 months before we put another one in. So
how does that thing work? You've mentioned ghrelin, and we've got leptin. I know about certain hormones circulating around. Is this a hormonal, or is it a physical reason, or we're not so sure?
Well, I think it's both. I think, you know, we think about it as a space-occupying mass. So simply, if you're already full, if you've had a big Thanksgiving dinner and you're feeling that, man, I'm really full, that's sort of how you feel when you have this device in. So you don't want to eat as much. But really, it's distending the stomach by being in there. Which decreases the ghrelin levels. That stretch tricks your body into thinking, I'm full.
Okay.
And it doesn't stimulate that hunger response as much. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of works as a kickstart, really. It's not a long-term solution.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can get you down 30, 40, 50 pounds over that 6 months and then work on your behavior after that, then people can maintain it. And the studies have shown that people have maintained at the one-year mark about 75% of their weight loss. So, you know, if they lost, 50 pounds, then they were able to keep about 40 of those pounds off.
And again, that's still better than most other non-surgical ways to approach weight loss and in the long-term outcomes, it sounds to me.
You know, it can be. If we look at just using medication-assisted weight loss, you know, we're looking at 5 to 10%, you know, weight loss results with that.
Right.
So overall, it's a good option for some people.
Uh-huh. What else do we need to say about surgery? We've got just a few minutes left. I have a couple of emails, but I really want to have the time to talk about particularly these new surgical techniques. Is the V-block something we need to talk about as well? Or I want to leave it to you to use this time the most effectively.
Yeah, the V-block is an interesting device. I'll spend just a minute on it, but it's basically, it's kind of like a pacemaker. That's put in two leads that go around the vagus nerves.
Mm-hmm.
And the vagus nerves are responsible. They run from the stomach to the brain that help send all these hormones. And so we can create an electrical impulse that kind of blocks that. And so the V-block, it works. You turn it on for about 12 hours a day. And during that time, you're less hungry. And so and it comes off and on. There's no specific diet that you need to be on because your anatomy is not rearranged. So it's really working on this hormonal component to surgery. But the results are fair, you know, 25 to 30% excess weight loss. So, you know, as you get more invasive, you also get better results. So really part of discussing with a patient is determining what risk they're willing to take and educating them on all the options. And that's a pillar of my program is educating everybody through a whole seminar that's always free because I think education and support should always be free for the patients.
We've only got just about 2.5 minutes left, and I'm going to have to apologize. I do have some emails I'm not going to have time to get to, but I think the way I would like to end the program is let you have plenty of time to have listeners hear what you think is the most important information you want them to take away and remember from this program about weight and weight loss?
You know, I'm a surgeon, so, you know, I think of things in the surgical perspective. But I think whatever you decide to do, if you're struggling with your weight, you know, explore your options and the whole spectrum of options. So I think it's important for a program to be able to offer you a comprehensive approach to weight loss. And that's whether you need to lose 10 pounds or 110 pounds and to do it safely. So what I would say is education is king, is get out there, do your research. If you want, you can go to our website or come in for a free educational seminar and really look at all the options. And for all the providers out there, I can tell you that bariatric surgery has made great strides in the last 10 years of improving our safety and our efficacy. And for those providers out there who don't believe in bariatric surgery, have always had a hard time bringing that up with patients, I would say, you know, make that step to take that talk with your patient and direct them to someone who can explain all the options.
I'm a pediatrician, and I hear what you're saying, and I think it's always a keeping up with what's going on, and I am impressed with the different options, the understanding of how the options and why some of these options are being used in lower and lower BMIs. But what about children? What can we say about adolescents and kids in the surgical options right now before we leave the program?
You know, surgery in kids is a tricky subject. You know, it's being done at certain centers. Certainly, we've looked at it, possibly things like these balloons that are non-surgical, don't alter the anatomy, might prove beneficial in kids, but right now they're not indicated at the moment. And we might get there, but, you know, I think for that child who is struggling with their weight, it's really needs to be addressed from a parental standpoint, from a society standpoint, of making the healthy changes early. And then, you know, we can explore surgical options when it's time.
Okay. Thanks very much. Let me apologize again. I do have a couple emails I did not get to, and I guess my best answer is look at our website, get Dr. Clark's website from that, and give their office a call and see if they can answer some of your questions for you. So my thanks to Dr. Justin Clark. He's a bariatric surgeon here in Anchorage. If you want to continue this discussion on obesity and bariatric surgery, you can join KSK on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org, where you can also find our archives. Next week, we're going to talk about something really dear to a lot of physicians. Medicare is changing how providers are being paid. It's no longer going to be fee-for-service. It's going to be payment based on objective measurements of value and quality. This is a big change. Next week, Nancy Fisher, who is the Chief Medical Officer for Region 10 of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is going to join us, and we're going to talk about why the changes are happening and what it's going to mean to providers. So join us next Monday, July 18th at 2 p.m. Repeats at 8 p.m. each Monday. Pat Yak is our Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron, our engineer of today's
production
program.
Of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.